File 6. At the beginning of the century, Vienna had already taken rank among those cities where social conditions are iniquitous. Dazzling riches and loathsome destitution were intermingled in violent contrast. In the centre and in the inner city, one felt the pulse beat of an empire which had a population of 52 millions, with all the perilous charm of a state made up of multiple nationalities. The dazzling splendour of the court acted like a magnet on the wealth and intelligence of the whole empire, and this attraction was further strengthened by the dynastic policy of the Habsburg monarchy in centralizing everything in itself and for itself. This centralizing policy was necessary in order to hold together that hodgepodge of heterogeneous nationalities. But the result of it was an extraordinary concentration of higher officials in this city, which was at one and the same time the metropolis and imperial residence. But Vienna was not merely the political and intellectual centre of the Danubian monarchy. It was also the commercial centre. Besides the horde of military officers of high rank, state officials, artists and scientists, there was the still vaster horde of workers. Abject poverty confronted the wealth of the aristocracy and the merchant class face to face. Thousands of unemployed loitered in front of the palaces on the Ringstrasse, and below that Via Triumphalis of the old Austria, the homeless huddled together in the murk and filth of the canals. There was hardly any other German city in which the social problem could be studied better than in Vienna. But here, I must utter a warning against the illusion that this problem can be studied from above downwards. The man who has never been in the clutches of that crushing viper can never know what its poison is. An attempt to study it in any other way will result only in superficial talk and sentimental delusions. Both are harmful. The first, because it can never go to the root of the question. The second, because it evades the question entirely. I do not know which is the more nefarious: to ignore social distress, as do the majority of those who have been favoured by fortune, and those who have risen in the social scale through their own routine labour, or the equally supercilious and often tactless, but always genteel, condescension displayed by people who make a fad of being charitable, and who plume themselves on sympathizing with the people. Of course, such persons sin more than they can imagine, from lack of instinctive understanding. And thus they are astonished to find that the social conscience on which they pride themselves never produces any results, but often causes their good intentions to be resented, and then they talk of the ingratitude of the people. Such persons are slow to learn that here there is no place for merely social activities, and that there can be no expectations of gratitude, for in this connection there is no question at all of distributing favours, but essentially a matter of retributive justice. I was protected against the temptation to study the social question in the way just mentioned, for the simple reason that I was forced to live in the midst poverty-stricken people. Therefore, it was not a question of studying the problem objectively, but rather one of testing its effects on myself. Though the rabbit came through the ordeal of the experiment, this must not be taken as evidence of its harmlessness. When I try today to recall the succession of impressions received during that time, I find that I can do so only with approximate completeness. Here I shall describe only the more essential impressions, and those which personally affected me and often staggered me. And I shall mention the few lessons I then learned from this experience. At that time, it was, for the most part, not very difficult to find work, because I had to seek work not as a skilled tradesman, but as a so-called extra hand, ready to take any job that turned up by chance, just for the sake of earning my daily bread. Thus I found myself in the same situation as all those emigrants who shake the dust of Europe from their feet with the cast-iron determination to lay the foundations of a new existence in the new world and acquire for themselves a new home. Liberated from all the paralyzing prejudices of class and calling, environment and tradition, they enter any service that opens its doors to them, accepting any work that comes their way, filled more and more with the idea that honest work never disgraced anybody, no matter what kind it may be. And so I was resolved to set both feet in what was, for me, a new world, and push forward on my own road. I soon found out that there was some kind of work always to be got, but I also learned that it could just as quickly and easily be lost. The uncertainty of being able to earn a regular daily livelihood soon appeared to me as the gloomiest feature in this new life that I had entered. Although the skilled worker was not so frequently thrown idle on the street as the unskilled worker, yet the former was by no means protected against the same fate, because though he may not have to face hunger as a result of unemployment due to the lack of demand in the labour market, the lockout and the strike deprived the skilled worker of the chance to earn his bread. Here the element of uncertainty in steadily earning one's daily bread was the bitterest feature of the whole socio-economic system itself. The country lad who migrates to the big city feels attracted by what has been described as easy work, which it may be in reality, and few working hours. He is especially entranced by the magic glimmer spread over the big cities. Accustomed in the country to earn a steady wage, he has been taught not to quit his former post until a new one is at least in sight. As there is a great scarcity of agricultural labour, the probability of long unemployment in the country has been very small. It is a mistake to presume that the lad who leaves the countryside for the town is not made of such sound material as those who remain at home to work on the land. On the contrary, experience shows that it is the more healthy and more vigorous that emigrate, and not the reverse. Among these emigrants, I include not only those who emigrate to America, but also the servant boy in the country who decides to leave his native village and migrate to the big city where he will be a stranger. He's ready to take the risk of an uncertain fate. In most cases, he comes to town with a little money in his pocket, and for the first few days he's not discouraged if he should not have the good fortune to find work. But if he finds a job and then loses it in a little while, the case is much worse. To find work anew, especially in winter, is often difficult and indeed sometimes impossible. For the first few weeks, life is still bearable. He receives his out-of-work money from his trade union and is thus enabled to carry on. But when the last of his own money is gone and his trade union ceases to pay out because of the prolonged unemployment, then comes the real distress. He now loiters about and is hungry. Often he pawns or sells the last of his belongings. His clothes begin to get shabby, and with the increasing poverty of his outward appearance, he descends to a lower social level and mixes up with a class of human beings through whom his mind is now poisoned in addition to his physical misery. Then he has nowhere to sleep, and if that happens in winter, which is very often the case, he is in dire distress. Finally, he gets work. But the old story repeats itself. A second time the same thing happens, then a third time, and now it is probably much worse. Little by little, he becomes indifferent to the everlasting insecurity. Finally, he grows used to the repetition. Thus, even a man who is normally of industrious habits grows careless in his whole attitude towards life and gradually becomes an instrument in the hands of unscrupulous people to exploit him for the sake of their own ignoble aims. He has been so often thrown out of employment through no fault of his own, that he now becomes more or less indifferent whether the strike in which he takes part be for the purpose of securing his economic rights, or be aimed at the destruction of the state, the whole social order, and even civilization itself. Though the idea of going on strike may not be to his natural liking, yet he joins it out of sheer indifference. I saw this process exemplified before my eyes in thousands of cases, and the longer I observed it, the greater became my dislike for that mammoth city which greedily attracts men to its bosom in order to break them mercilessly in the end. When they came, they still felt themselves in communion with their own people at home. If they remained, that tie was broken. I was thrown about so much in the life of the metropolis that I experienced the workings of this fate in my own person and felt the effects of it in my own soul. One thing stood out clearly before my eyes. It was the sudden changes from work to idleness and vice versa, so that the constant fluctuations thus caused by earnings and expenditure finally destroyed this sense of thrift for many people, and also the habit of regulating expenditure in an intelligent way. The body appeared to grow accustomed to the vicissitudes of food and hunger, eating heartily in good times and going hungry in bad. Indeed, hunger shatters all plans for rationing expenditure on a regular scale in better times when employment is again found. The reason for this is that the deprivations which the unemployed worker has to endure must be compensated for psychologically by a persistent mental mirage in which he imagines himself eating heartily once again. And this dream develops into such a longing that it turns into a morbid impulse to cast off all self-restraint when work and wages turn up again. Therefore, the moment work is found anew, he forgets to regulate the expenditure of his earnings, but spends them to the full, without thinking of tomorrow. This leads to confusion in the little weekly house housekeeping budget, because the expenditure is not rationally planned. When the phenomenon which I have mentioned first happens, the earnings will last perhaps for 5 days instead of 7. On subsequent occasions, they will last only for 3 days, as the habit recurs. The earnings will last scarcely for a day, and finally, they will disappear in one night of feasting.